Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with the Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to the Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis. How are you today?
I'm well, except I find disturbing several things in the news, which we will share with
almost
our listeners.
Always I find disturbing several things in the news. So which one have you decided to talk about today?
I have here an article from the Baltimore Sun by Jonathan Rockoff, and the Bush administration has said that the government doesn't need more inspectors or new technology to police slaughterhouses in light of the country's largest beef recall earlier this year. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has enough food inspectors and they say, this is from Richard Raymond, the Undersecretary for Food Safety, they have enough inspectors and videotaping meat plant operations would be costly and practically difficult to implement.
Okay.
So let's get what happened here. A USDA certified slaughterhouse with USDA inspectors in the building were taped by an animal rights group sneaking in and putting themselves at risk to tape what was going on in there. And what was going on there was not only disgusting, but in violation of federal regulations.
It was so unpretty.
When sick cows or downer cows fall or are so sick that they can't even make it to the slaughter. They have to be inspected by a USDA inspector, and they can't be tortured as they were tortured. All of this horrible stuff was going on in a slaughterhouse. And they do everything they can to keep those slaughterhouses out of the public view. The USDA inspectors were there, and this toady, Richard Raymond, the Undersecretary for Food Safety, says, no, we don't need any more inspectors. Well, what were you doing? What went wrong?
Forget about needing more inspectors.
Largest meat recall in history.
To me, I almost say diabolical, but I'll say stupid, if that's a better word. Thing mentioned in this article is that it's impossible. It's just not reasonable to put cameras there.
Right, right. It's not as simple as a camera, said Raymond.
But it is as simple as a camera.
Yeah, it's pretty much simple as a camera.
It's as simple as a camera. Okay, your 7-Eleven has a camera in it with a recorder on it.
Right. Every convenience store has a camera in it with a recorder on it. Why can't the USDA take slaughterhouses, which make a heck of a lot more every month in profits than a convenience store, and say, listen, you got to put in 20 cameras.
And
that's all.
And you want to talk about, even as just a deterrent, if people know they're being filmed, they're not going to do some of the things that these people were doing in the slaughterhouse. They simply won't do it for fear of retribution. Because they know, because anybody who was doing the things that were happening on this video knows, you have to know that they're wrong, okay? You have to know that people, that there would be an uproar if people got a hold of a video of something like that, that people would rebel against that. So if you know you're being filmed, simply some of those things wouldn't have happened. Even if those films are only occasionally reviewed, some of those things would not have happened.
But you have to look at what is coming out of, okay, the Department of Agriculture is, I mean, the Bush administration is horrible on all this. But the mm-hmm. Department of Agriculture, across many administrations, has been horrible on
sure.
this, Democrat and Republican. But how this toady, Richard Raymond, the Undersecretary for Food Safety, can say, but it's not as simple as putting up a camera.
But it is.
Okay, hold on a second. Yeah, it's as simple as, with no explanation as to why it's not, you know, as simple as putting up a camera. You put up a camera, have that camera broadcast, you know, don't even record it. Just have it broadcast to the public.
Yeah.
You'll get, you know, citizens will watch it and mm-hmm. record if anything goes wrong. And he was testifying before the House, and Mr. Raymond's response angered House members who said the recall of all beef slaughtered in the Hallmark Weston plant in Chino showed the need for improvements. We're trying to look for solutions. If you would work with us, that would help, said Representative Diane E. Watson, a Democrat from California. They just... You know, their answer is, Oh, well, there was the largest food recall in history because these activists snuck in and filmed it. So what we're going to do is make sure we don't let the activists
right,
sneak
don't
in
let
anymore.
The activists anymore.
We're not going to look. That way we'll never find a problem.
I don't understand. Unfortunately, I think I do understand why you wouldn't just open these things up. The problem is you don't want to open this up to public scrutiny. Because you know that things are wrong.
That's the only
reason.
Because
you know that things are going wrong. You know we're not doing it the right way. That's the reason that you wouldn't want somebody watching this at all times. Why otherwise would you care?
Right. And the Federal Department of Agriculture, as opposed to the New Jersey State Department of Agriculture, which is a wonderful organization that is under threat right now with Charles Cooper as the mm-hmm. Secretary of Agriculture. But the Federal Department of Agriculture is populated with agribusiness toadies who... You know, they regulate the industry, then they work for the industry. Then they regulate the industry, then they work for the industry. So nothing happens. On another front, the Bush administration is likely to move research on one of the most contagious animal diseases in the world, that's foot and mouth disease, from an isolated island to the U.S. mainland near herds of livestock. That doesn't seem to make a lot of sense.
Seems like a bad idea.
We have this hoof and mouth disease is now studied on an island that is only accessible by helicopter or ferry, and there are very strict rules. The foot and mouth virus can be carried on a worker's breath or clothes mm-hmm. or vehicles leaving a lab, and is so contagious that it's confined to Plum Island, New York. It's been there for 50 years, accessible only by ferry or helicopter. Researchers who work there are not permitted to own animals at home that are susceptible to it, and they are required to wait at least a week after leaving before attending an outside event where an animal might perform like a circus. So now we're going to move that onto the mainland.
Mm-hmm.
Do we remember what happened in 2001 in Britain? They killed millions of animals because of an outbreak of this disease. Why do we throw caution to the wind like that?
I don't understand it. Again, in this instance, I don't. It's not transparent to me why you would want to do this. Why is this important? Is Plum Island a valuable island in some way? That it's a valuable piece of real estate? Why? What is the motivation for moving something so serious back to the mainland?
In a simulated outbreak of the disease, and part of an earlier U.S. government exercise called Crimson Sky, they run these role-playing mm-hmm. things, these models.
They do it for all kinds of things.
The model wound up with riots in the streets after what would happen in such an outbreak, if it's a widespread outbreak. National Guardsmen in this exercise wound up being ordered to kill tens of millions of farm animals, and there was a crisis because the troops would run out of bullets before they could kill all of the farm animals. Kansas would have to dig a ditch 25 miles long to bury the carcasses.
We don't want this to happen in our country.
And the Bush administration assures us that, you know, oh, well, we have the safety measures in place. Why not leave it on the island? I don't understand this reckless disregard for reason
mm-hmm.
and safety. You know, I mean, it makes a lot of sense to have it on an island where it can't get off.
I think sometimes in this country we're not afraid of the right things.
It really is.
I think that's really what it is. We're not afraid of the right things.
Well, we're going to be talking about some of the right things with Corby Cummer, who writes for The Atlantic magazine. He's one of our favorite food writers, and he'll be joining us in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:15. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. And our guest today is Corby Cummer. His work in The Atlantic has established him as one of the most widely read and authoritative food writers in the United States. He's the recipient of 3 James Beard Journalism Awards, including the MFK Distinguished Writing Award, and he joins us today.
Corby Cummer, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, man, thanks for coming back.
Always a pleasure.
Now, we want to talk with you today about slow food. You've written in the February 08 issue of Atlantic Monthly, you write about the University of Gastronomic Sciences. What the heck is that?
Oh, you know, it's a great place, and I'm lucky enough to be preparing to go back to teach there next week. I have this fabulous gig twice a year. I teach writing seminars. The one I'm going to now is a master's program for people who've been through college. And it's taught all in English, but it's in Italy, so you get to tour prosciutto factories and Parmigiano factories, and they pay for you to travel to Spain and south of Italy and all these great places, working on farms, learning about how food is actually made. The idea is they want to train the leaders of the food industry. So, you know, they're infiltrating.
But it's very hands-on. I mean, everything I've read is this is, you know, you're getting dirty.
You know, it's everything except cooking. You know, they now do run a cooking school, but that's separate from this university. I teach in the master's program, but the main deal is at a undergraduate program right near the headquarters of Slow Food, which is near the great city of Turin. That's a full 3-year program that grants you the equivalent of a BA. They're now applying for recognition in America so that it'll count here, but it counts all over Europe. So far, the Americans who go generally already have a BA and have already been to college, but not all of them. That's really hands-on, and it's extensive, and you have to study all the dreary things you have to study at college, too, like, you know, math and physics and science.
Well, and we should point out that the degree is in gastronomy. That's the name of the degree, right?
Well, you know, it is the name of the degree, and it's starting to be recognized as an academic discipline in America. There are a couple of master's programs in gastronomy in America where you get a degree in gastronomy, like in my own Boston Metropolitan College, which is part of Boston University, offers one. Jacques Pepin, the legendary cook who got himself a PhD, is a frequent teacher there, and he was one of the founders. So it's getting serious, and it's acquiring some recognition in America. So far, no undergraduate school I know of in America offers a degree in gastronomy, but that might be coming too.
Well, tell us exactly what a degree in gastronomy entails.
Well, you know, gastronomy, as the founder of Slow Food, Carlo Petrini, always says, is multidisciplinary. It's everything. So certainly you've got to study culture, sociology, languages, and industry, because that all goes into the food that is produced and that we eat.
Well, now, you know, it's funny. I'm going to quote from your own article. You talk about gastronomy being interdisciplinary, and you're quoting or paraphrasing Carlo Petrini, who's the founder of Slow Food, of the Slow Food Organization internationally. And he insists that the degree involves economics, environmental science, history, biology, anthropology, and social justice. Let's talk about the social justice aspect of gastronomy, because I think that's a newfound and powerful alliance of interests there.
It's certainly what brought the Slow Food movement to international prominence, and the reason that Petrini, who himself was a former leftist political activist, founded it. The idea that you have to pay farmers a fair wage for their work. And so nothing is, he has this good, clean, just mantra. So you have to think about your food as being good, so it's, you know, not overly processed, and it's good for you and that kind of thing. But the clean part means that it doesn't harm the environment. So environmentalism is a big part of Slow Food and one of the reasons it's gotten traction. And then just the people who grow it have to have been treated fairly and have to have been paid a decent wage for what they make. And all those things, when you think about it, are constantly under attack. Right now we're only reading about the disaster that biofuels and ethanol are to farmers who can't make a price actually growing food anymore. They have to grow corn for fuel if they want to get government subsidies. So in every country, there are pressures on farmers who want to actually grow good food for us to eat.
You know, a lot of people don't realize, and we've certainly dealt with it on the show many times, is that the people talk about these farm bill where we subsidize our farmers, and we don't subsidize our farmers. We subsidize
the foods.
Certain crops, and those crops aren't the vegetables that you get in your farmer's market. Most of the farmers you meet in the farmer's markets don't get a thin dime from the government in the farmer's
market. You know, they're nothing that we think of as food, and they're not the farmers down the road, and we go to their farmer's markets. I broke my head for a month and a half trying to study the farm bill and what could actually relate to farmers markets and farmers we know. And there's almost nothing. They throw a couple of bones in farmers market promotion programs to try to please, you know, bleeding heart liberals like us who actually care about food and farming. But mostly it's just for agro industry, and unfortunately the Democrats largely caved into this year.
I think it's funny that you say that, because literally there is almost nothing. You know, there's a tremendous amount of resources and dollars being put into it, and almost nothing for the traditional farmer.
Hey, when we come back, we're going to talk more with Corby Cummer about these issues that are near and dear to our heart and near and dear to your stomach. So stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagut and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and we're speaking with Corby Cummer of The Atlantic Magazine. He is one of America's best writers about food. And, you know, Corby, I want to pick up the conversation with the current disaster that is biofuels, because I'll tell you, when ethanol first started to come to the fore, there were a lot of people on the left who were very much for it. I remember Al Franken, who's a guy that I listened to on the radio when he was on Air America, and they sort of rallied around this, but it was a horrible idea, isn't it?
Oh, it couldn't be worse for international, for if you've read about the World Food Program, which is facing global crisis and about to face riots.
Yep.
All over the world. We haven't seen food riots in decades.
In Japan, they're out of butter. In Japan. We're not talking about third world countries. We're talking about Japan, which imports 80% of its food. But, yeah, it's crazy. Now, you know, when our research, what we believe all along is that the government subsidizes this corn, which makes the corn cheap, which then makes it reasonable from an economic standpoint to take this subsidized corn and make fuel, but without the government subsidy, it doesn't make
a disaster,
sense,
yeah.
Even economic sense. Is that correct?
Right. Farmers would never be growing it, and they certainly would never be growing corn on the vast scale they do. Even farmers, we think of the big industrial farmers as being kind of evil because they have vast tracts that they're preventing from good young farmers growing food, but in fact they were forced decades ago to consolidate or not qualify for government subsidies for the big crops, the big five as they're called, and not get subsidies at all and have to go out of business. So everybody's been put in a bind by these food subsidies that began during the Depression in the 1930s as a way actually to feed people and keep farmers employed. So it's a terrible perversion and irony. And when you talk about the Japanese with butter, the idea is that so many animals that produce food need this corn to survive. So it's not just corn that we're being denied eating. It's lots of food from animals that need the feed. It's all going into biofuels now.
When we come back after the news, I want to talk about what the implications are with this world food crisis for the kinds of foods that seem to me to make more sense than ever, local, sustainably produced food. And we'll talk about that with Corby Cummer after the news. So stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC, with The Restaurant Guys.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Today we're talking with Corby Kummer. He is a James Beard Journalism Award winner thrice. You can read his work in The Atlantic. And we're talking about slow food, which Corby writes about better than probably anybody in the country. And we're dealing with how the current food shortages and food crises are, what the ramifications are and what the implications are for the kind of food that slow food champions, which is local, sustainably produced food. And before we get into that exactly, I just want to point out that not only without a government subsidy does ethanol not make sense financially. So all this is a way for those large agribusiness firms to collect the subsidy. It also doesn't make sense. People say, well, it burns cleaner. Well, except that to produce corn in particular, it's a very petrol-intensive type of farming. So you use a lot of gasoline and fuels to produce
corn,
fertilizer and run the tractor and all that. So it's really, as far as the environment is concerned, it's a net-net, isn't it? It's a net zero, right?
Oh, no, I think it's worse. I think it actually takes more energy to produce this ethanol than it does to consume it. And, of course, it's not for our cars. There are very few people who are equipped to actually use it. So it gets shipped again. So not only does it take lots of energy to grow the corn that's made into this biofuel, it then gets hauled and shipped to the large industries that have retrofitted and changed so that they can take advantage of government subsidies to buy ethanol. So it's this ludicrous mismatch, and it's a terrible way of using land that can be used to grow food. And we're seeing people in poverty all over the world who can't afford to eat bread, especially just this week, newspaper reports about Haiti and Egypt, where people can't afford to feed their families. They're looking at their hungry kids, and in Haiti, they're eating mud pies.
American dirt pies, yeah.
It's horrible.
Well, now, let's talk about the implications for a diverse network of food producers of the kind that you champion all the time and that certainly Slow Food seeks to protect and enhance.
Well, they have to fight the idea that they are supposed to be in business and not getting government subsidies. They're supposed to be finding a market for their food so that they don't have to move off the farm and into the cities the way people in the developing world almost exclusively have to. So Slow Food is trying to find a way to promote them, to find markets for their food by establishing farmers markets, getting their products promoted in local restaurants, building small networks. One of the things they've done is this fall there's going to be, every 2 years they run this conference called Terra Madre that brings farmers from villages all over the world, many of whom have never left their own countries, let alone come to Turin, Italy, where it is, the third week of October. And it's incredibly moving because they're all facing the same challenges. They have enormous amounts in common, just not language or where they live. And so they come together, and even if they've never traveled, I shouldn't make them out to be, you know, dull or illiterate. They have internet. Everybody's got internet. And so Terra Madre has created this kind of alternative network to the food industry, and they're trying to build this every 2 years at this conference. And it's already having cultural exchanges and especially information exchanges, things that work. And almost every activist I know in America who's interested in being really moved and understanding what small farmers all over the world face finds her or his way to Turin the third week of October every other year. So it's this year if you want to mark it on your calendar.
We'll actually put that up on our website so you can find it more easily.
Which
is restaurantguysradio.com, I should point out.
A moment ago, Corey, you talked about one of the goals of Slow Food is to promote these local producers in restaurants, in places where they can get some publicity and thereby create a demand. I'm always infuriated. At the end of the year, people will come up with these lists of things they're tired of seeing. And every year for the last couple of years, on somebody's list is, oh, I'm so tired of seeing the name of this farm or that farm
on the menu,
on somebody's menu. And it just makes me crazy.
Because it's with the name of the farm. that you're able to market that. And frankly, look, you have to charge. If you want to source locally, you often have to charge a few more dollars than if you order from the dry goods truck and they show up with your tomatoes.
There's more work to do.
So we have to support the local farmers, and we have to call attention to where that's coming from.
But
well, it's more
it.
Expensive, and it's also you have to figure out how to change your menu on a dime because supplies change mm-hmm. day by day in a way they don't when you're ordering from a normal supplier. I think the objection was when it started looking like a one-upmanship status game.
Yeah.
But if you say this guy's from right near you and people can understand it's not from Chino Ranch in San Diego, it's from a farm three mm-hmm. towns away, they can like it. And I guess downplaying it a bit, but making clear, this came from a local farm, it's only available this week and it costs us more to get, I think that's a message people have gotten.
You know, it is, and I think one of the things that people said is food prices started to rise before they got as, you know, in the crescendo that we're seeing now. Some people were saying that maybe it's not a terrible thing that, and this is fraught with problems, but some people were saying with the rise in commodity food and the cost of it, in some places, maybe this makes the local sustainable stuff seem more
affordable.
It's funny you say that, because I'm about to write my own list of stuff that I want to keep and that I want to discard of new ideas. And one of the things that I'm kind of fiendishly delighted in is the rising price of organic food in the supermarkets, because as much as I believe in organic food, I'm very dismayed by the invasion of industry into organic production. And I would much rather support local food. And so if the rise in food prices and organic prices in the supermarket means people don't have the excuse not to buy local food because it costs more, well, you know, maybe that's a good thing. They'll understand that good food is local food and local food costs more.
Let's talk about the intrusion into the organic production, which was once, you know, local and organic were close to synonymous in practice, if not in theory.
And you never heard Walmart's name.
And
you
now,
never heard Walmart, yeah.
Well, and now there's big business in organic. People don't want to put the synthetics in their body, and so they like the organics. But, you know, there's a statistic that we were talking with Andy from Gourmet Garage, and I did some research before that show. And the statistic is that 80% of the food in your supermarket, you know, you think you have a lot of choice when you go to your supermarket. 80% of the food produced in any given supermarket can be traced back to six parent companies. Six parent companies produce 80% of the food in your market. Those huge parent companies have now gotten into the organic market and tried to change what organic means even. You want to talk to us about that, Corby?
Well, I don't think people understand how organic has been railroaded, and that I was talking earlier about the good, clean, just pillars of the slow food movement. Well, unfortunately, organic may correspond to clean, but it isn't always so morally clean, and it's often not just at all. These big companies that Andy, who I think is great, was talking about that he has to buy from at Gourmet Garage, they could be treating the Mexican farm workers, illegal immigrants in California, and especially Florida, which is even more of a scandal than California. I was at a Senate hearing about Florida tomato workers last week. They can be treating them, you know, just as badly as non-organic industry does. So it doesn't mean that the organic label is not hiding some kind of social injustice you'd be unhappy to know about.
You know, I think it's funny, though, but all of the big producers, when they get into the organic labels, they're all like, the labels sort of imply this is made by a barefoot hippie, you know, two towns away, and you find out that it's made by a huge corporation.
Well, it's not only that. One thing I found out when I started looking into barefoot hippies and their descendants is, they often can't afford to get organic certification. It doesn't make economic sense for them. They can't wait 3 years to get to clean up their land or get the certification. Now, it's great that there's national certification, but I just don't think it's the be-all and end-all, and there I part with some of my friends in America. I think that supporting a local farmer who's got, especially in the Northeast where we live, a hard enough time just paying rent and surviving is the most important thing.
So you guys are talking about barefoot hippies. I thought you were going to Foot Fuzz, and I was very concerned.
Well, you know, you can always find a list of local farmers on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. Coming up, it's strawberry season, and you're going to have Ben Konopacki from Indyke Farms. We're going to do a dinner at his farm on June the 1st. But there's a million ways to support your local farms, and you have to be willing to ask questions. And we'll be asking...
And I have to say, if you look for slow food chapters, it depends region by region, but I'm very proud that Boston, I had nothing to do with building it, is now sponsoring exactly the kind of dinners and farm visits that you're mentioning and that you guys do at your own restaurant.
Well, and when we come back, we're going to tell you about a new chapter of Slow Food that's starting right here in New Brunswick, and so you'll be the first to know. So stick with us. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:46. I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953. Hey everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys, with Corby Kummer. Corby, we were talking about Slow Food before, and it's really a tremendous organization. And I've recently been approached about starting a Rutgers University chapter of Slow Food, which is I've been asked to sit on the board of. And I think it's tremendous. We've had a great, we have a Princeton chapter that's run by a friend of ours, a guy named Jim Weaver, who's a chef, Trey Piani. And it's coming to New Brunswick, and it's
and we're happy to be part of the leadership.
I'm amazed at the young people. You know, these are college students who are starting it. The president's going to be a Rutgers college student. It really has caught on in the young generation, hasn't it?
You know, this is the wave of the future. It's funny you say this because the end of the piece I wrote, Slow Food University in the Atlantic, was a bunch of university students coming and addressing a global meeting of the slow food leadership around the world. And everyone was knocked out by these 12 kids who got up on stage and saying, we're starting chapters in our universities, and we need your help, because it was something that Slow Food hadn't done particularly. And Slow Food turned on a dime. They changed everything. They said, our funding priorities are now helping these young people establish on-campus chapters. A woman at Boston University has established one of several in Boston, but she was the first, and I went and spoke there. And, of course, you know, those kids know so much more than we do and are so much more aware of things. It's much harder for them to cook. It's harder for them to get out and go to local farms than it is for other regional chapters, but they are great, and the more we can do to support them, the better.
One of the things you said earlier in the show was people would be unhappy if they uncovered what was going on necessarily in organics, but I think in with all their food, and one of the things that Slow Food is really important in changing is it changes the way people look at the way their food is produced and gives them kind of a look into the way it should be produced.
It does, and I think that the minute you visit a farm, it's sort of different. I'm sure that you guys have farmers come to your restaurant and present their beautifully cooked produce, because you cook it beautifully, or their meat. And meeting them is one thing, and it's great. And, you know, let's say they're in Tattersall shirts and overalls with suspenders or something. So it's one picture, but when you go and you visit a farm and you understand how relentlessly 24-hour that business is,
Yeah, it's like the
how
restaurant.
How hard
business.
It is to pay the bills.
Well, you know, it's funny. We do a lot of interviews, and Mark and I don't generally do first interviews anymore, but we always do the final interviews for anybody who works in our organization. And one of the things that we always ask is, you know, what's the hardest job you've ever had? And kids who were raised on farms are the hardest working people. Mm-hmm. If your dad owned a restaurant or your mom owned a restaurant, or you grew up on a farm or you worked a year on a farm, I know you know what hard
you
work
basically
is.
Get the job.
Yeah.
Really. You know, there's no question. And one of the great things about Slow Food University is everybody works on a farm for at least a week.
Hey, so talk to us about this university again. Now, I read in the article about the Viaggio, a little bicycle trip that you all did along the Po, or that was done by along the Po. Talk to us about that.
Well, that was a 24-day trip, and in fact, it was to go and document. The Po River runs straight across the north of Italy, east-west. And it's now largely industrial, but it fed Italy for hundreds of years, and there are very few farms left. But there are some. And so kids got on a bike, and it was, you know, partly a rolling publicity stunt that Slow Food wanted to bring attention to the university within Italy, because it's been very successful among foreigners. There's a big foreign population, but they want, you know, they want more Italians who, I shouldn't generalize, but they don't take undergraduate education all that seriously. And they wanted them to know about it. So they went and they did videos and they did interviews with fishermen, farmers. Like, I was at the end of it, which is above Venice, and so we saw the delta where rice is grown. And you know, talk about backbreaking work, rice paddies. Mm. You can understand why there are so few of them left and there are so few rice industries. But we were talking earlier about the fuel industry. It's the fuel industry that in the late 60s, they started drilling for oil around these deltas, and the ground level sank so much that the deltas were flooded and lost.
So, flooded with seawater.
With seawater, exactly. The seawater invaded the fresh, so there was no more rice cultivation. All across the north, there's the same story with pollution. I think if we visit, who live in the northeast, I recently wrote about a community in Holyoke. They're Puerto Rican children of immigrants. The immigrants all grew up on farms, and they're all now learning to farm and starting these urban farms. But Holyoke was itself a farming area that is now, you know, post-industrial, and now it can go back to farms. But the farms were obliterated all across the Northeast. So Slow Food was doing that kind of trip, understanding where the farming heritage was and where the opportunities are to revive it.
Corby, we were supposed to spend, 10, 15, 20 minutes talking about Holyoke today, but we're out of time. Will you come back and talk to us about it the
I
next time?
I will always come back, and I'm so glad it was about Slow Food, because I'm so glad my publishers are republishing my book on Slow Food in paperback just now.
Oh, that's great.
And the title of that book?
The Pleasures of Slow Food, Chronicle Books.
We're going to put that up on our website. We're also going to put information about Slow Food's University of Gastronomic Sciences in Italy, and we'll also link you to Corby Comer's work. Corby, thanks again.
Thanks, Corby.
Oh, such a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We'll be back in just a moment with the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. You know, I sort of obliquely mentioned that it's still in the works, but there's going to be a Rutgers chapter of the Slow Food Movement, and I think I'm going to be a co-chairman or maybe
something.
Just on the board. I don't
whatever,
know.
Whatever, we'll be involved.
Said yes. We'll be in somehow, but we're going to try and
We'll be involved. It's an exciting project. I think that it's been a long time in coming to a university like Rutgers. You got a great food science program here
Cook
College.
But it's also the getting those young people involved who mm-hmm. are, and I'll tell you, I meet young people today who know a lot about food.
Yep.
And, you know, it's sort of the Food Network, know a lot about chefs and cooking, but it's also people who know a lot about how food is produced and care about these things.
But we even see, because this show is podcast, and obviously that's a I don't want to say a generational thing, but certainly younger people are podcasters than more terrestrial radio listeners. Because the show is podcast, we see a lot of our listeners and who are really into food and interested in food are those younger people.
And you can look for us. We'll have the president of the new chapter on board, the founding president of the new chapter on board. We'll have him come on the show to talk with you about it. One of the things I know they're planning on, and is already in the works, is they're planning on having a farmer's market one day a week here in New Brunswick.
Oh, it'll be great. It's, you know, there was, they tried this, I'm going to say 10, 12 years ago. There was a tiny little market, and it never really got traction in New Brunswick. And I definitely think the time has come to try something like that again. I think that certainly if you get the restaurants involved and Slow Food behind it, you'll get enough publicity and enough people to go out there and support it.
Yeah, so we'll put the information, as soon as that information is solidified and becomes available, we'll have someone from the Rutgers chapter of Slow Food on the show. We'll put the information up on the website, and you'll be hearing from us. Don't you worry about it as the summer marches on. I hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's noon.